This is David Duke. This is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, wherever they may live upon the earth, and certainly important to all people. A lot of things are breaking across the world right now in terms of the exposure of the Jewish supremacist influence upon the government and the United States and its inordinate power. And the American media. It's a power in media that can't be denied. And it's obvious for anyone who wants to do research in the issue. Those who are new to this issue, I urge you to go to my website, davidduke.com. That's www.davidduke.com. And go to my preview chapters of Jewish supremacism and read the chapter on who runs the media. Jewish media supremacy. That's right. And I promise you, when you read this chapter, you will find that the power of the Jewish extremists and the American media is far greater, well, than you ever could have imagined. It's an amazing power, ladies and gentlemen, and you will see it laid out in detail in that chapter of Jewish supremacism and also in the chapter of My Awakening. And by the way, I'm working on updates of both of those books to get those up to the current time in both research and study in all these areas, as well as a complete and documented index and bibliography. So we're working on those projects, and hopefully in a month or two that'll be done. I'm also working on a couple of other books. I am very much overwhelmed, though, by this program, by my teaching, by my work, by my research, by the internet, by the publications, by our organization, by so many things. Hopefully I will be able to continue to do this work for many years ahead. I'm doing the best that I can. I sometimes don't get everything out as quickly as I'd like to. I've been working on this third book, what I consider my opus, for quite a while. It's a very different kind of a book. It's more of a book, not of poetry, but a more poetic style book about why we're here, what we're doing, what we're fighting for, and basically how we go about achieving the victory. I'm giving all my ideas about how to achieve a victory for the ideas and the principles that we believe in. And one principle I must say that we believe in is we understand the right of all people, including our own, to preserve their own heritage, our own values, our traditions, to live the way that our fathers and mothers and grandmothers and grandfathers and our ancestors lived. Every people has this desire. And we certainly, as European Americans and as Europeans all over the world, we have that desire as well. And we have a right to that principle. We have a right to live. You know, nothing is said to be more execrable than the alleged attempt to exterminate all Jews of Europe or the world in the Second World War. Now, there's many different views of that process. There's no question that many Jews died in that conflict, and that there were atrocities that took place against Jewish people. There's also no question that there were terrible atrocities that took place against German people. For instance, the bombing of the cities of Germany, the bombings which literally burned alive hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children, and certainly something that's a true traditional style Holocaust or death by fire. And we can take a look at the ethnic cleansing of millions and millions of Germans in the winter of 1945 and 46, and what happened there, ladies and gentlemen, 44, 45, and 46, actually, because the cleansing went on for well over 2 or 3 years after the occupation of these territories by the Soviets. And we can look at the terrible atrocities that took place earlier in the Soviet regime. But, ladies and gentlemen, there is argument about different aspects of the so-called Holocaust. Were the Germans trying to eradicate or destroy or kill all the Jews of Europe? And there's certainly arguments on both sides of that question. And there's a lot of major people who've looked in the question and found that they don't go along with the current procedure. There must be freedom of speech. There must be freedom of thought and freedom of inquiry in these areas. In fact, in all areas of life. But I must say this, that when I talk about the Jewish question, we must get away from stereotypes, because the first time you begin to criticize some of the Jewish extremists that dominate our media and that really run Israel and that really control America's support for Israel and for the Iraq war, immediately, and you start to communicate this to friends or family, they will say, well, you hate all Jews, or you're against all Jews. Well, first of all, it's not a question of hate, and we're certainly not opposed to every Jew. There's individual Jews that aren't doing any terrible thing against the United States of America or controlling our policy or putting Israel first or are selling us out in treason like Jonathan Pollard or leading the pornography rackets like so many of them have done. There's certainly individual Jews that we certainly respect. There's individual Jews who, in fact, are fighting against the Jewish extremists and understand that the Jewish extremists pose a threat, not just for the Gentile community or for the Palestinians in the Middle East, or for the American people in guiding us into these terrible wars, such as what has happened in Iraq and what's very likely to happen in terms of Iran. And they too are concerned, and they also believe that ultimately it's dangerous and damaging against the Jewish people themselves. They want to live by the standards and values of our culture. But there's no question that the organized powers of Jewry, the American Jewish Committee, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, ADL, so many, the Organization of Jewish Presidents, which is a compilation or a composite, really, of the leading Jewish organizations in the United States. These people have an agenda that's absolutely, totally subservient to the interest of Israel, and really what they consider to be the agenda of the Jewish people, even if it's damaging to the agenda of the European Americans who built this country. For instance, almost every major Jewish organization very much supports massive non-European immigration, both legal and illegal, into the United States of America. But these same Jewish organizations support Israel, a nation that has very strict immigration laws that limit immigration only to Jews, that have strict segregation between Jews and non-Jews, that don't even allow a nation, that doesn't even allow the marriage, a legal marriage, to take place between a Jew and a Gentile, and won't even permit a Kohen, which is they consider to be their of their Kohanim class or their priest class, like the elite of Jewry, kind of like the SS of Jewry in the sense, a spiritual SS. The Kohanim won't even be allowed to marry a fellow Jew or a Jewish person who happens to be even partial Gentile genetics. In other words, they can be a full-fledged Jew of religion, but if they have a drop of Gentile genetics, a Kohen can't marry another Jew in Israel. That's, ladies and gentlemen, that is absolute racial ideology. And Israel and Judaism certainly has a root in that. Now, some people argue whether Israel is based on race or not, but I believe fundamentally it is race. And I can tell you why. Certainly they have a religion, and I think their religion is basically seen as a means of keeping their people together. Their religion is a racial religion. That's what it's really all about. And for instance, in Israel, you can immigrate to Israel from anywhere in the world if you're of Jewish descent. Now, somebody who's of Jewish religion, obviously, in 99% of the case, because Jews do not seek converts, they've always set up incredible barriers against conversion. Again, that's because they want to preserve their heritage. But a Jew who is non-religious from anywhere in the world can immigrate to Israel. In fact, be given tremendous financial incentives, land incentives, opportunities in Israel if they'll just come simply from being a person of Jewish descent. That's right, of Jewish blood. So that's the critical issue as far as they're concerned. And there are many Jews in Israel, by the way, who don't believe in God and who are not religious. But they also tolerate the religious running of the state because they believe that that sets up the sets up and preserves the traditions, the values, and the preservation of the Jewish people. And they're right, because Judaism is essentially a racial religion. It's not a universalistic, a universal religion such as Christianity or such as Islam. It is a religion basically for the Jewish people. It doesn't seek converts, and in their elite orders, you know, there's never actually been a Gentile who's ever acquired any prominent role within the Jewish religion. None, period. And of course, there have been many Jews who have had prominent positions in the Catholic Church, cardinals. There have been Jews, of course, who have involved in the founding of the church. We can go on. There are no Gentiles allowed, basically, in that leadership apparatus of Judaism. We have a situation, ladies and gentlemen, where we have a double standard, and we have a situation where people are not being allowed to really examine the issue. And the way they're able to do this is by control of the media. Now, over the last two or three programs, I've been talking about the factors that have gone in to so-called anti-Semitism. And I've discussed what is anti-Semitism. And the way we learn about anti-Semitism today, of course, is primarily by racial supremacists and radical Jews, supporters of the apartheid state of Israel. They're the ones who tell us what anti-Semitism is. They're the ones who define it, write about it, speak about it, and they form the consensus of what anti-Semitism is. And of course, anyone who dares to discuss the facts of life in America, the facts that the Jewish extremists have incredible economic and social and political power and media power in the United States, they're immediately anti-Semitic, simply for telling the truth. A very fine and brilliant man by the name of Robert Fisk, a reporter in the Middle East, extremely heroic reporter. He's gone out where a lot of reporters, he calls it hotel reporting. A lot of the American reporters and other reporters will stay in their hotel rooms or stay in guarded, huge compounds on American military bases. They won't go out. Well, he's risked his life on countless occasions to go out and get the real story. And he has been brave enough, also intellectually, in terms of his career, to talk about the truth about the Israeli state. He exposed the Israeli attack at Qana, which was a United Nations refugee area in which they killed dozens and dozens and dozens of men, women, and children in a terrible act of terrorism. He has documented fully the Sabra and Shatila massacre in Beirut, and he's even talked about the fact there was another massacre at a football stadium in Beirut that is not even spoken about much in the world by the world press. His name is Robert Fisk. And Robert Fisk has recently written an article. In fact, it appeared today or yesterday in The Independent in Britain and has been copied all over the world. And the name of the article is called The United States of Israel. Very, very cool and very clever title. And he talks about the Walt and Mearsheimer report. And, of course, he mentions me. He mentions me because, of course, I've been used to attack the report because it's been said that these fine Harvard and University of Chicago researchers have written the same thesis that I've been writing about for years, that essentially it's the same ideas, quoting from the same sources in some cases. And but this has been a means to attack the writers of that program. Now, Fisk doesn't really attack me or anything, but he says this is obviously how they've been trying to refute the report, which is a ridiculous kind of refutation. It's certainly a non sequitur, and it's certainly an ad hominem attack to an incredibly ridiculous degree. You know, if an idea is bad because a supposedly bad man agrees with it, we're never going to come to the truth or find out what's good or bad about anything. You know, if Joseph Stalin advocates brushing your teeth, is that going to make us say, well, Joseph Stalin advocates this and says brushing your teeth is healthy for your teeth? Is that going to make us say, well, because Stalin killed millions of people and he was a terrible repressive tyrant, is that going to convince us that we shouldn't brush our teeth? You know, facts are facts, ladies and gentlemen. So today I'm going to continue with my anti-Semitism essays and about the roots of anti-Semitism. As I said to begin with, you know, most of the writings about anti-Semitism, I start out with my chapter in Jewish Supremacism and My Awakening with a kind of survey of some of the encyclopedia articles in anti-Semitism, and I point out that most of these articles are written by radical Jewish extremists, and almost all their references of what they refer to people to read in terms of books and articles about anti-Semitism are also written by Jewish radicals. That's like trying to learn the truth about communism by only reading anti-communists, or the truth about anti-communism by only reading communist sources. It's ridiculous. It's kind of like to learn the truth about Christianity by only reading anti-Christian sources, or the truth of the anti-Christian position by only Christian sources. You know, you've got to have, you know, a balance, and in a search for the truth that is absolutely necessary, ladies and gentlemen. And of course, in the topic of anti-Semitism, there is no balance. None at all. And so I've been talking about some of the reasons why there's been opposition to some of the Jewish groups in history. Now, this doesn't mean that every Jew is evil. And again, our opponents will take us and twist everything out of proportion. And it's not evil or hateful to talk about elements of Jewish extremism and Jewish corruption any more than it would be evil to talk about elements of white corruption in the past, or any other corrupt activities or nefarious activities by any group in the past. And in fact, you can read plenty of books, thousands of books, that expose so-called white supremacism or white hatreds or white extremism or Muslim extremism or even Christian extremism, a Christian fundamentalist exposing certain sects. But if you start talking about Jewish fundamentalism and Jewish extremism, boy, then you're in trouble. If you start talking about some of the real reasons for opposition to Jews, then they call you basically an anti-Semite, suggesting that you are trying to fire up a crematorium in your backyard. So let's talk about this a little bit. And I want to go into the banks and stock exchanges today and how these are manipulated and how they have been historically by some of the Jewish elite to encounter and to accumulate huge sums of money. And with that money, of course, money means power. It has, money makes power politically. Money makes power in terms of the ability to buy and influence media. Money makes power in so many different areas. And let's talk about some of that accumulation of money. Let's go into the banks and stock exchange. The first family of banking over the last two centuries has been the Rothschilds. From them came the most powerful banking houses of Europe. The founder of the House of Rothschild, Mayer Amschel Rothschild, was born in 1743 in Frankfurt am Main in Germany. Amschel studied first to be a rabbi and then decided to go into money lending and finance instead. He ultimately became the financial agent of the British government during the Napoleonic Wars, interesting, and launched the greatest banking houses of Europe, with his sons going to the continent's major capitals and establishing the banks there. Now, when I was very young, I read a flattering book on the Rothschilds that related to the story of Mayer Amschel's most famous financial coup during the great battle between Napoleon and Wellington at Waterloo. The London stock market suffered as traders worried about the possibility of Napoleon's victory. Amschel saw the important battle as an unparalleled business opportunity, knowing that if Napoleon won, the stock market would crash, and that if France lost, the market would soar. Amschel set up a system whereby he'd learn the outcome of the war before anyone else got the news. Using carrier pigeons over land and a series of boats with signal lanterns at intervals of a mile or so across the English Channel, he learned before anyone else that Napoleon had lost at Waterloo. Rothschild then had his confederates put out the false information that Napoleon had won. Now, this lie led to a devastating crash of the London Stock Exchange. valuable stocks sold for pennies on the dollar. Amschel and his Jewish associates, knowing that Britain had actually won, bought up the stocks for a pittance. Overnight, as the London market learned, finally, of the British victory, these stocks that they bought for pennies became worth a huge fortune. Now, the book and many books about the Rothschilds talk about this fraud, and most of them present this fraud as clever and admirable. But one must pause to think about the fortunes lost, fortunes that had been acquired by years of toil and genius, of businesses literally stolen from their creators, of lives broken. Did the author of the book on the Rothschilds that I read, did he think that this huge fortune simply materialized out of thin air? Did the author care that money comes not only from those who create and lead companies, but also from the hard work of thousands of laborers? Now, such a theft affects salaries, working conditions, employment, and many other factors. Many hundreds of thousands of people ultimately had to pay the high cost of Rothschild's swindle with the London Stock Exchange. Now, Mayor Amschel used the enormous wealth he acquired through his Waterloo scheme, among others, to establish his five sons, Amschel, Solomon, Nathan, Carl, and James, in their own banking houses across Europe. As discussed in my chapter on the Russian Revolution, the Rothschilds have readily used their massive wealth to influence nations on behalf of Russian interests, such as when they ripened Russia for revolution by canceling loans in protest over the Tsar's May laws. These were laws written in the latter part of the 19th century to protect the peasants from Jewish loan sharking and thievery. Now, Rothschild's ill-gotten wealth also effectively bought his family the first Jewish seat in the British Parliament, and even membership in the British aristocracy. By combining the power of their own family's huge banks and other Jewish-owned banks, they could literally bring a nation's economy to its knees. By dominating international banking, they could set their own financial terms to cash-hungry nations and amass even greater riches. Because of the competitive advantages of Rothschild's international contacts, Jews dominated private banking throughout Europe. For instance, there was almost a complete absence of Gentile banking firms in Prussia in the late 19th century. In 1923 Berlin, there were 150 Jewish banks and only 11 non-Jewish banks. In the stock market, schemes similar to Rothschild's Waterloo ploy have been used for generations, finally resulting in the center of world trading, Wall Street, becoming dominated by Jewish stock and investment banker operations. In the book Our Crowd, and in a relatively more recent book, The New Crowd, The Changing Jewish Guard on Wall Street, Jewish writers Judith Ehrlich and Barry Rehfeld fawningly relate the overwhelmingly Jewish takeover of the nexus of the American economy. Ivan Boesky and Michael Milliken, who stole close to $2 billion between them, are glowingly praised for their brilliance and market savvy. Now, when I was in high school, my father had some modest stock investments, like most Americans do, and his broker was a politically conservative Jew by the name of Randy Newman of the firm of Kohlmeier and Company. Now, I got a job as a very young man working for Newman, plotting curves. That's the term for charting stocks and commodities. My father thought it'd be an excellent experience for me and a summer job to learn about these kinds of economic issues. At the time of my employment, I had little understanding of the Jewish issue. I liked Newman, and he always seemed to have a pertinent statement handy in response to the latest outrages of liberalism. Newman was that rare bird, especially during those times, of being a conservative Jew. Newman had made a fortune in the market, and while I worked for him, I discovered the real secret of making money in the market, and the reason Jews have come to dominate the brokerage industry. Newman was constantly on the phone with his fellow Jews in New York and Chicago and Washington, D.C., each member of a circle. Knew other Jews as well as a few Gentiles in business, government, media, and at the critical junctures of the market. In his conversations with me, Newman often spoke using words that I could not understand. And they were, in fact, Yiddish. Sometimes he'd tell me what they mean. And in his conversations over the telephone, he was constantly speaking only Yiddish. Sometimes after the telephone conversation, he'd quickly write out an order for a major stock or commodity purchase and have me run it to the clerk for submission. That's how it was done in those days before the computer generation we have. All we had was a computer monitor then. I remember frequent transactions that netted him tens of thousands of dollars, and I asked him what his secret was, and he told me that he had no secret. Information, he said. That's how you make real money in the market. You have to get the information before the crowd gets it. Once it's in the newspapers, it's too late. Now, I guess he felt safe bragging to a quiet high school student, and I listened and paid attention, and I learned a lot. Let's take government, he said. Imagine you knew someone in the Federal Reserve who had inside information that Arthur Burns, he was the head of the Federal Reserve at that time, planned to raise interest rates. After all, someone has to know these things before the world knows. How could you do in the bond market, or for that matter, a dozen other markets that are extremely interest rate sensitive? Or how about if you knew a friend in the Department of Defense, and he knew if Lockheed or McDonnell Douglas would get the new fighter plane contract? Do you think you could make a fortune with that information? Face it. Someone must know ahead of time. Now, this is Randy Newman talking to me. I'm trying to reconstruct it as close as I can. Or how about if your friends knew where the next military base would be opened? Think you could do pretty well in real estate? Or say you knew someone at the Justice Department would let you know that they will drop their antitrust litigation against IBM. When that news comes out, what happens to the stock? Would you buy IBM stock? And it's not just government information that can make you king's ransom. For instance, if you had friends at IBM and knew before anyone else that IBM was going to give a contract for 100,000 computer cases to a small company, what do you think might happen to that penny stock? There's a million ways, he would tell me, how information means money. I asked Newman if insider trading was illegal, and he told me, quote, they might as well make breathing illegal. He said it was technically illegal, but that it was almost impossible to prove, and that it was not really even looked into except in the most blatant cases, usually involving huge amounts of money. Years later, such manipulation of enormous sums of money led to the biggest stock market scandal in history. In 1986, Dennis Levine, Ivan Boesky, Martin Siegel, and Michael Milliken were charged with insider trading of stocks and bonds worth billions of dollars. Now, this is fully about 30 years after Newman told me these things. Boesky admitted his guilt and was fined $100 million, and millions more were eventually paid by Milliken, who, after the fines and litigation and some jail time, came out a very rich man. In 1987, Milken made $550 million for his activities the year before. That's more than all but the top 41 of the Fortune 500 companies earned that year. He personally made that much. Levine, Boesky, Siegel and Milken were guilty of the greatest financial fraud perpetrated since the Rothschild theft of the English Stock Exchange. And I must say, it's very minor compared to the fraud that has been committed in Russia by the Russian oligarchs, and again, people of the same extraction, and people supporting the same extremist Zionist causes, such as Vladimir Kaczynski. Now, it should be noted that with their Jewish lawyers and facing Jewish judges, that the men I just mentioned, Siegel, Boesky, Milliken, Levine, they all served light sentences in minimum security federal jails for their enormous crimes. It is instructive to note how the Jewish power structure reacted to the Boesky affair. Some top Jewish leaders, including Lawrence Tisch, who later became top man at CBS, Felix Roetten, now U.S. Ambassador to France, and David Gordas, Executive Vice President of the American Jewish Committee, came together to do damage control. The Palm Beach Jewish World quoted Rabbi Gordas as saying that because of the arrests, Jews would be seen as, quote, exploiters of the economy and profiteers. If my friend Mr. Newman was right, and inside information equals money, in a modern market economy, what does that mean for the most cohesive and organized group in the world? Many Jewish young people are as knowledgeable in finance from an early age as many Gentile kids are familiar with the star players of the Super Bowl or the World Series. Ivan Boesky is exceptional only in the magnitude of his theft. Insider information of one sort or another is incredible power in the hands of people who know how to make use of it. Around the corner, or around the world, it is the greatest weapon in an economic war, and the spoils of that war are not only the luxuries that money can buy, but also the enormous political and media power it purchases. The fact that tiny Jewish minorities often rise to economic dominance in Gentile nations of both the Mideast and Europe certainly played an important role in the repeated rise of anti-Semitism. Even when the businessmen act perfectly legally, a cohesive and powerful team effort will consistently amass collective power over a scattered and individualistic mass. Such is the elemental nature of business. When the team strategy is combined with inside information garnered by Jewish penetration to upper-level administrative roles in government and business, the accumulation of incredible financial power and economic wealth are inevitable. I was soon to learn, though, that the secrets of Jewish financial success were far more than simply intelligence and team effort. I came to learn about an unexpected Jewish dominance in some of the most unsavory criminal enterprises that have ever afflicted mankind. And at that point in my life, I turned to investigating how the darkest sides of the Jewish character influenced the rise of anti-Semitism. I read that Jews had played a surprisingly powerful role in organized crime from ancient to present times. From having watched an endless stream of Hollywood movies portraying an Italian flavor to gangsterism, I did not expect that the worldwide Jewish involvement in organized crime made Sicilians look like very small-time crooks. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the close of my economic part of The Roots of Anti-Semitism. I talked about that in some previous programs. Not tomorrow, but Monday, I will begin talking about The Roots of Anti-Semitism and the next part, and that will be dealing with crime and treachery, such as their domination of organized crime in America, even more so than any Sicilians or Italians, about their criminal actions in the Russian Revolution, about their actions in the so-called Red Mafia, the most dangerous criminal organization in the world. I will talk about their role in the slave trade, which is a very interesting issue. Whites are constantly blamed for slavery and made to feel guilty for slavery. Well, what about the fact that the slave trade for literally a couple thousand years has been dominated by Jews? And I'm going to quote Jewish sources, Jewish historians, major Jewish people, and about that. I'm going to talk about their role in white slavery. It's going to take a couple broadcasts to get through a lot of this, but I think it'll be quite a good education for all of you to understand that so-called anti-Semitism or opposition to the Jewish group, the Jewish nation, has not always simply been some sort of unreasonable religious dogmatic opposition, but has been a reaction to certain actions that they have taken and the negative aspects that they've engaged in. Again, I will quote from Arthur Kornberg, quoting Theodor Herzl, who was the founder of modern Zionism, one of the major Jewish figures of all time. And he said, quote, "Anti-Semitism is an understandable reaction to Jewish defects." Not all Jews, but it's certainly something that we have to begin to recognize and understand if we're going to deal with some of these effects of Jewish supremacism. Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's been very good to be with you again today, and I will be with you on Monday. Don't forget that tomorrow that you're going to have our fine individual, Professor Bob Whitaker, will be on discussing the issues of the day. Very clever man, intelligent man, with a fantastic turn of phrase, a great wit, and I think you're going to enjoy the program very, very much. Until Monday, all I can tell you is God bless you, take care, and let's continue to spread this information, you know, all over the United States, all over the world, and let's liberate not only the European people, but all the people who are affected from the dangers of Jewish supremacism. Thanks a lot. I'll see you on Monday.
This has been David Duke for our heritage and our freedom.